Welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report in exile, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Today we present excerpts from The Charleston Five Comes to Harlem, an event recently sponsored by the Black Radical Congress, the New York City Charleston Five Defense Committee, and New York City Jobs with Justice. The Charleston Five are South Carolina unionists who were framed on rioting charges while peacefully picketing to protest the use of scab labor at the Charleston port. The event featured Charleston local 1422 Longshore president Ken Riley, along with Carol Pittman for New York City Jobs with Justice, Marty Goodman for the New York City Charleston Five Defense Committee and TWU Local 100, Amiri Baraka, Bill Fletcher for the Black Radical Congress, Amina Baraka, and Charlene Mitchell for the United New York chapter of the Black Radical Congress and Local 371 DC 37 AFSCME. And now to introduce the program from the Black Radical Congress and Professional Staff Congress AFT at CUNY, Leith Smallings.
On behalf of the United New York chapter of the Black Radical Congress, I'd like to thank all of you for coming out tonight in these times of enormous turmoil. And it's not surprising that the media did not highlight the deaths of more than 1,000 trade unionists and hundreds of undocumented workers who lost their lives at the World Trade Center. As we mourn their loss and struggle against terrorism, war, and the militarization of our society, we must not forget the ongoing struggle for social justice. I'm Leith Mullings, and I will be your chair for the evening. I teach at the City University of New York, and I'm an active member of the United New York chapter of the Black Radical Congress. But tonight, I'm most proud to introduce myself as a trade unionist and a member of the new caucus of the Professional Staff Congress. The new caucus of the Professional Staff Congress is an insurgent rank-and-file movement that has recently won a tremendous victory in capturing the leadership of the Union of City University. And that's why you see us and will continue to see us pilloried in the newspapers. But we're a great union. We are here tonight because for the last 100 years, the struggles of black women and men in organized labor has been at the heart of the black liberation struggle and all progressive struggles. What do these workers struggle for? Black workers fight for more than wages and benefits. They fight for justice for all of us. For this reason, any strategy for labor, for black empowerment, and for progressive politics as a whole must be based on the black labor movement. So it is not surprising that black organized labor has been targeted for elimination through outsourcing, privatization, and union busting. The struggle of the Charleston Five is at the heart of any movement around class, race, and repression. I'd like to begin the program tonight by having some of our co-sponsors bring greetings to the Charleston Five. And we're going to begin with Carol Pittman, who is with Jobs with Justice.
I'm Carol Pittman. I'm the director of New York Jobs with Justice, and I am very glad to be here. And I want to... I'd like to thank the New York United BRC for giving us this opportunity to co-sponsor this event. We are very glad to be here. Jobs with Justice is a labor community coalition, and we bring labor and community together for the right to organize and for workplace justice. Earlier today, we co-sponsored with the Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church a lunchtime briefing with Bill and Ken for Brooklyn clergy and community leaders. And I have to say that although I knew about the Charleston Five before our briefing, I knew about it, I could kind of explain the case. We brought lots of people to our event. But there were a number of things that Bill and Ken said that were very instructive and that really brought it home to me. And I realized that actually the fight for the Charleston Five is the fight for the right to organize.
That's
right. Before this afternoon, I sort of knew what a right to work state was about. I knew that organizing in a right to work state, because I am around the trade union movement a lot, and this is something everybody here knows, that not being in a right to work state, that it's very hard to organize. But I didn't realize that the mere act of joining a union in a right to work state is viewed as an act of provocation by the powers that be, by the establishment, and is therefore a huge act of courage on the part of the worker to join a union. And that's not right. It shouldn't have to be that way. I also know that just the act of fighting for their union and getting out there and fighting for the right to organize, fighting for their union and fighting for the right to organize, was enough to bring down the wrath of the South Carolina racist establishment and to basically imprison them for now over 2 years. As a parent, is very close to my heart. These guys, the Charleston Five, are some mother's sons, they are fathers, they are husbands. And for over 2 years now, they have had these bracelets on where they can only go to work, to a union meeting, and then back home. And from 7 to 7, they are confined to their houses. 4 of them are fathers. And that's an awful lot of missed games, missed PTA meetings, missed contests and spelling bees, and just evenings spent with your kids, watching them grow up. 2 years is a long time in the life of children. I just want to say that you and I sitting here tonight know that this is not right. We know that we cannot let this stand, and that in defense of our own right to organize, that we have to stand with the Charleston Five. And I'd like to encourage you to be there for the Charleston Five and for the workplace struggles of other people. We will be working with the BRC and other organizations, the Solidarity Committee, to make sure that justice is done to the Charleston Five. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Our next speaker is Marty Goodman, who is an activist transit worker and an activist in the transit union, who will speak for the New York Charleston Five Committee.
Good evening.
Good evening, Marty.
And I'd like to welcome Ken Riley to wartime New York. And we're going to be changing the agenda on Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Bush. We're going to be going about the business of fighting for justice, and calls for unity just doesn't seem to ring true to a lot of workers like myself in New York City. I'm a transit worker in the Transport Workers Union, Local 100, subway and bus workers, and I know that we were under severe attack, like the brothers in Charleston are. Last contract time, December 1999, we had 2 unconstitutional injunctions on our head from the MTA and Mr. Giuliani, saying we couldn't even discuss striking or doing any job actions, and we were getting no support out there. And we understand very well what it is to be under attack by the state in a very real way, and in a way that we're going to remember. We sponsored an evening with Ken Riley speaking for the Charleston Five back in August. We had a wonderful presentation there. A lot of people were there. And this was sponsored by our New York City Charleston Five Defense Committee, which has been working now for several months on this case. And we want to urge you to get involved. And this is an ongoing struggle. You're going to hear much more about this tonight, of course. But there will be a day of action in November at the onset of the case, in which solidarity activists around the country and indeed around the world will be participating, and we urge you to join in that fight. Got a meeting coming up Tuesday, October the 23rd at 6:30 p.m. That's Tuesday, October 23rd, if you want to get involved in this very important organizing for the Day of Action, which will be, if I didn't mention it, coordinated with the onset of the Charleston 5 case being heard in South Carolina. That's going to be at the SEIU office at 330 West 42nd Street, 330 West 42nd Street on the ninth floor. I just want to say that other events we've been involved in, a contingent at the Labor Day Parade on September 8th, which was endorsed by the New York City Central Labor Council. We also had the Central Labor Council sponsor buses on June 9th that went down to Columbia, South Carolina, in which we joined a wonderful labor and solidarity rally there in support of the Charleston Five and calling for freeing the Charleston Five. So in closing, I want you again to please get involved this international protest in November, and please participate. Thank you.
Our next speaker, Amiri Baraka, needs no introduction. He is the poet laureate of our movement, and he is the founder of the Black Arts Movement and a stalwart, longtime struggle for Black liberation. Amiri.
You know, these times, we see in 10 months what this counterfeit president for this fake democracy has brought us to. And while we oppose terrorism, why? Because it drives the people to the right. It separates the people. It separates them from revolutionary pursuits. Now, Giuliani, they want to give him 3 months. I'd like to give him 3 months in a joint. And Bush now emerges, you know, someone who stole the election, a coup. And I would say, you know, that this began with the murder of Kennedy. That's what I think. You know, and whether the Watergate break-in, you know, the Contragate, that they have been planning this for a long time. On your net, get the BCCI, Pakistan, Bush. Who put bin Laden in there? Bush won. Who is the Holy Trinity? You know, Bush the Father, Bush the Son, and the Unholy Ghost, the CIA. That is the Trinity. And so this movement, not only this war, but as underneath this war is a constant elimination of our rights. For the Afro-American people, we know this has never been a democracy. It's never been a democracy. Native people know that. It's never been a democracy. How can it be a democracy? Chicanos know it's never been a democracy. But now, what little pitiful democracy they wanted to, they're going to take that. And the trade unions have always been victimized. How many people are unionized in the United States?
13 million.
I mean, what percentage of the workers?
13%.
13% of the workers. You understand what I mean? So don't ever be tricked into thinking this is a democracy. It is a struggle to make it a democracy. I think in terms of criticism that it's a mistake for the BRC not to get a unified general line. We have to get a general line, the struggle for democracy, the struggle to build a united front now. We wanted to have a united front against imperialism. Now we have to broaden that, a People's Democratic United Front, because now they're talking about fascism. See, and I know in the end who the Arabs and the Muslims are going to be. You understand? I know who the Jews are going to be in this country. We don't need yellow stars. So remember, that repression moving everything to the right under the guise of war. So we need a unified position, a unified line. And under the question of the struggle for democracy, then the question of the Charleston Five, the question of all these things need to come as specific aspects of this general line. But we can't continue to have fragment here, fragment here, fragment here, fragment. We have to have a general line and a structure that carries out that line. Yeah, I'm telling you what I think. And one of those problems that we have always is people who can make revolution with their mouth. You know what I say? Fake revolution. People who want to turn down a Ford grant. Who got to say capitalists? Hey, who else got money? I thought that's what I was saying. Go out in the street and tell people you would turn down a Ford grant. And see what they would tell you. You're crazy. The question is, you have to utilize this bourgeois democracy to the extent that you can, and at the same time struggle to overthrow it. And in terms of these right-wing, you know, you got a fake left, and you got these right-wing nationalists who are celebrating terrorism. You are here, fool. First of all, like I said, terrorism drives people to the right. And you cannot celebrate the Taliban or Bin Laden. We are not fighting to prop up these mullahs and these kings and the bourgeoisie of these countries. We need to be finding out, what is the left doing? What are the trade unions doing in Iran, in Iraq, in Afghanistan? Why don't we focus on that? What about the people who are fighting to overthrow that? Not Bin Laden cutting off people's arms and stuff like that, making women wear veils. So don't get souped up with this right-wing line. We support revolutionary democracy and socialism, not the rule of the mullahs and the king. And I think the role of the BRC, and I'm going to try to sum this up, that we have to, as black people, we have to understand what the double consciousness is. Everybody say, you got the double consciousness. Of course. We black and we Americans. We black, obviously, we Americans on paper. You have to take that question of the double consciousness and use that to struggle on one hand for democracy and equal rights, and at the same time, self-determination. When we say self-determination, people get scared. What do we mean? If you don't have self-determination, you can't even have this. You understand? You have the right to create the weapons that will liberate you. You understand? You have the right to create those weapons yourself. If it wasn't for, like, Stokely Carmichael and Martin Luther King, wouldn't be no black people registered in the South. The government didn't do that. Kennedy didn't do that. Young kids did that. Martin Luther King's people did that and fought those people for that. So that's what we mean by the question. And in terms of, we always talk about the black brother, there he goes, he's national. Look, in South Carolina, which is the heart, you know, when after the Emancipation Proclamation, the legislators of South Carolina looked like the NAACP convention. Because that is the heart of where the black people live, and that is the anchor put around all workers' necks to the extent that they can keep the South under their feet with a Confederate flag in Mississippi is the extent that they can keep the whole people there. Only other thing I'd say is that local politics is very important, y'all. We can win that. You need to get involved. I'm sorry that Felipe didn't win, but we need to get involved in local politics. You need to go out and secure some safe house, town, city, region, something. People talking about revolution can't even elect a dog catcher. So we welcome Ken Riley. We welcome Ken Riley. And we have to understand that the question of the unions is a question of democracy. And the question of the struggle for democracy is what we have. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Amiri. It's my great pleasure to introduce the next speaker, who will introduce Ken Riley. The next speaker is Bill Fletcher, and I have had the pleasure of working with Bill Fletcher for years in the Black Radical Congress. Bill Fletcher is presently the vice president of the George Meany Center of the National Labor College, but more importantly to me, he is the national chair and organizer of the Black Radical Congress. And Bill has a long history in working with labor and has been dedicated to the struggle for black liberation. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Bill Fletcher.
Thank you very much, Leith. Good evening. When Leith introduced Amiri, and I realized I was going to be speaking after Amiri, I wanted to go for a little walk. It's like, how can one speak after Amiri? I met Amiri, and he probably doesn't remember this, in 1974 when I was 5 years old. No, seriously, I met him when I was a student activist, and it's an honor to continue to work with the brother. And he has helped to contribute to the development of the BRC. So, on that note, Ken Riley, in May 2000 at the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists Convention, I had the opportunity of meeting him. And I'm fond of telling the story. A brother named Royce Adams, who's in the BRC and he's also in ILA, came over to me. He says, Bill, I got someone for you to meet. I said, yeah. He has a story to tell you. Now, I'm very jaded. I've been in the movement a long time, and I've heard a lot of stories. And everyone has their own compelling story. So I said, okay, sure, I'll listen to what he has to say. So Ken began to describe the situation that happened in Charleston. And my jaw dropped. I mean, I just said, huh? That happened? And he said, no, this is what happened. And I could not believe it. And it's not because of any great illusions about democracy in the United States, but the blatant nature of what happened in Charleston was something that really is stunning. And when you hear it from Ken, you absolutely understand what I'm saying. Ken gives a compelling and eloquent advocacy of the case of the Charleston Five. And he has put this case on the map and has been willing and able to move around the country to bring this case to people, to inspire activists, and really help us to build a national defense effort. This is a case that I would argue represents, like few others, how determined our enemies, business and their governmental allies, how determined our enemies are to eliminate all opposition to their global ambitions. And I think we have to really think about that when we're understanding what exactly went down in Charleston in January 2000. It's been an honor and a pleasure to work with Ken Riley. Over the last 15 months, several of us have worked very hard with Ken, inspired by Ken, to convince others in the union movement that this was a case that was critical. It wasn't simply another case. It wasn't just something that people should nod at and keep moving. It was a case that was really central to the future of organized labor. It was central to the issue of organizing the South. It's central to the issue of fighting repression. It's central to the issue of inspiring people. Because one of the things that this case brings out is courage. Courage and hope. And one of the things that's so clear is that when people have neither, we are defeated. When people have courage and hope, they are capable of doing incredible things. With a leader like Ken Riley, the effort that we've conducted has been worth it. And so with that, I'd like to ask you to join with me in welcoming Ken Riley, president of ILA Local 1422.
This is not our first time in New York. We've probably been here now at least three or four times. And I see a lot of the same faces that I saw the very first time that tells me how much they're interested in this case and sincerely want to see a successful conclusion of this particular struggle. And let me just tell you, on behalf of all the people that we represent back in Charleston, we really do appreciate all that you have done for us and continue to do. Because, you know, like I said, when this struggle began, we didn't really know about these type of things. We are only 3.8% organized in the state of South Carolina. There's not much going on, had been going on with the labor movement. It was dead, it was tired, it was asleep. We didn't really know what struggle was all about. You know, my local was founded back in 1936. And there have been a couple of strikes back in the days of my father. I'm a second generation longshoreman, but the newer workers down there never really got a feel for what those type of struggles were back in the 30s when these guys were fighting to organize. So when we got involved in this particular struggle, we didn't know what to do. Only thing I know that 4 years ago, when I took office 5 years ago now, that I felt that our union, blessed with all the resources that we have, should have been doing more to make a difference in the life of working people in our state, families. Because, you know, workers in South Carolina are still oppressed. Minimum wage is the prevailing wage. You know, legislation has just been introduced into our house in South Carolina that would make it illegal to have a living wage campaign. That bill, in essence, says it will be illegal for any municipality, any government body, to negotiate a living wage that is higher than the federal minimum wage. So you see, that's the type of conditions under which workers are operating every day. So, you know, we felt the need to do something, and we got involved. And because of that, and being involved in the community, we thought that when we got in this struggle, the least we could do is reach out to the community for whom we had helped, and maybe we can get some support, and maybe we can win this particular struggle. Little did I know that that community extended well beyond the boundaries of Charleston, South Carolina. That community of workers extends all the way here in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Detroit, Boston, all these cities we have been, also all around the world. But you know, Bill kept telling the story of how we met in Atlanta. But you know, let me tell you something. A lot of people will give you promises from the lips. But when it comes time to putting in the time, to working, to bring about a resolution or something, very few will stand and let the actions back up what the words have stated. Bill didn't do that. Like he said, he got very involved from that moment. He said, look, you all have to get with the state, AFL-CIO, and you have to make a request for me to come down and find out what this is all about. We made that request in a very short period of time. Bill came down to Charleston. We met with the state AFL-CIO president, some of our legislative representative, myself, and we spent an entire day analyzing what the problems were in South Carolina, because what happened to us on the night of January 20th was a result of the type of things that plague our state. It was an underlying reason why this happened. You've heard about our battle with the Confederate flag. That's symbolic. That's only the symbol of the type of atrocities that take place in our state. You know, workers being thrown into mental institution because they want a union representation in their plant. Thrown in a mental institution. I want a union in our plant. Okay, we'll fix you. The next day, this guy's truck on the way to work, surrounded by cops, dragged out of his truck at gunpoint, handcuffed, taken to a hospital where he was examined for a mental condition. They took him from there, injected him against his will, and committed him to a mental institution for 2 weeks before the union could get him out. Workers in plants becoming sterile because of contamination of lead to their bodies. Family dying with lead contamination. Every time there have been a labor struggle in the state of South Carolina, we have had to reach out to these people and try to come to their rescue. But you know, when we started become involved is when we became the target. We became the target. When we was confronted with the situation back on January 20th, our state government, who had already pledged, being controlled by the Republicans, that they were going to rid our state of labor unions. That was their number two item on their agenda in the year 2000. Number one, everyone likes this one, we're going to improve education. Number two, we're going to get rid of unions out of the state of South Carolina. We're going to improve the right to work laws. When we were successful in electing a Democratic governor back in 1998, and I was then nominated to the board of the State Ports Authority, that nomination was defeated because the state chambers of commerce issued a grassroots alert to 2,800 different businesses. Get in touch with your senators. We cannot allow this nomination to go through because it will send a message to the rest of the world that South Carolina, our pro-business state, is now open to trade unions. That nomination was defeated, and if that wasn't enough, they celebrated, had a big party one weekend. The next Monday, a bill was introduced, now called the Ken Riley Bill, into the House of Representatives that will make it illegal for any card-carrying member in the state of South Carolina to serve on state boards, agency, or commission. That bill has passed the House then. We killed it in the Senate. It's been reintroduced this year, and it's now on the calendar for full discussion in the Senate. We testified that it was unconstitutional, that if it passed, we would sue the state of South Carolina. It doesn't even matter to them. This is what the agenda of the right-wingers in our state looks like. We just came out of AFL-CIO state convention, where it was reported to us by the minority leader in the House that, let me tell you people, do not be mistaken, there is no other agenda in the South Carolina legislature other than the agenda of the state chambers of commerce. The state chambers of commerce right now represents the agenda of the New South. All the multinational corporations, all the domestic corporations that's moving from the North heading South, all these strong unionized plants and distribution centers that are now heading south, they're coming to South Carolina for one or two reasons. First, they say, well, we got a very strong port system. We do. We are the fourth largest port in the country, second most productive in the world, only behind Hong Kong. All that is true. But the second and the third reasons are the ones we must pay attention to. The availability of cheap labor and low union density. That's why they come. And how they find out about it? It is posted on the website of our state, Department of Commerce. Bring your businesses to South Carolina. We have the most productive workers in the world. But by the way, they're paid 26% less than the national average. When you ask them about these type of things, why do you market your citizen in such a fashion as this? Well, have you seen anything on the website that's not true, Mr. Riley? Are they not the most productive workers in the world? Yes. Are they not paid 26% less than the national average? Yes. Then what is your problem? You see, Mr. Riley, when we go out there on these trade missions to try to get businesses to relocate to our state, we offer them tax incentives, but so does the other states. So we have to have something a little better than them that we can offer. And what we can offer is cheap labor. So you see, South Carolina is now the third world alternative. Forget about Mexico, forget about Indonesia, all these other places. Stop by South Carolina. We got a third world-like conditions right there. And you know, the only deterrent, the only voice, the only chance that working people have in South Carolina is the labor unions. We only 3.8%. Now up to 4% because organizing is on the rise. And that in itself generated another grassroots alert just about 2 months ago. Grassroots alert. Union organizers are getting busy. Went out to 2,800 businesses in the state of South Carolina. Beware. Labor organizers are getting busy. We ourselves were engaged in an organizing drive just a few months ago. July 26th was the election day, against the non-union company that took our work that got us in this predicament to begin with. And you know what? Into that campaign, an element that plagues the South greatly, and especially the state of South Carolina, entered into that campaign, the element of racism. It was a predominantly black local trying to organize a non-union firm. My local just happened to be, I don't even know how to do the math on this one, we have about 800 members, and only two are white. Everyone else is African American. And when the leadership of that organization went into that situation and tried to organize this plan, anyone care to guess how the vote came out? Or how? I'll tell you how it came out. It came out right down the racial lines. The whites voted against the union. The blacks voted for the union. Now, we weren't a group of organizers coming from out of state trying to persuade South Carolina workers what we can offer you, what we can do for you. Here are workers making 60 cents less an hour than we were making 25 years ago. 25 years ago with absolutely no benefit whatsoever. And here we are working on this side of the docks, and we are making $25 an hour. They're making $8. We have benefits. They have none. We have a great big union hall to show what workers together can accomplish. They have nothing. They get hired out in the rain. And yet, right there in front of their faces, we show them what the benefits of becoming a part of a union is all about. The blacks saw, all of them are poor. They're making right above the minimum wage. The poor blacks saw the advantages. The poor whites saw the advantages, but say, I see black. And therefore, the vote came down 13 for the union, 12 for management, with 9 challenge ballots. And what we have done, we had pledge cards on 90-some-odd workers, where by the time they got through eliminating, we were down to 30. And that's how we got to that split. But we just pulled back that election, and we're going to have another election within the next 6 months. Because we didn't want to take the chance of coming up with a tie vote and losing the election, or winning by one and then having to be tied up in court for 2 years. So now we have qualified some additional workers, but what they have done now is brought in a lot of Latinos, Mexican workers, undocumented workers, to try to dilute the strength of the black votes because all the new qualifiers are black. And the reason, let me just explain why the situation is like it is and why my local is predominantly black. When the work was backbreaking, grueling, hard, blacks were recruited to do that type of work. I have an original newspaper from 1947 that I'm having framed right now where the single largest ad on the front page of the classified section is colored longshoremen's wanted, apply at Union Pier, 60 cents an hour. The whites were recruited to do the clerical, the tracking of the cargo. Therefore, we have our sister local that's clerical that's 100% white. And that, you know what? And that pretty much carries straight throughout the South. Once you cross into North Carolina, you'll find that in Wilmington, in Charleston, in Savannah, in Jacksonville, right on down around through the Gulf. That's pretty much the way it is. But when this predominantly African-American local started to bring about changes in our state, again, we brought the wrath down. We protested a non-union ship. We was confronted with over 600 riot cops. These guys that you're trying to defend right now was beaten, thrown into jail. We had to bail them out three separate times. Even when a local magistrate threw all charges out of the courts, no evidence introduced against them, this state attorney general, carrying out the agenda of the right-wingers, went to a grand jury and sought indictments on them and got them because, you know, there's no defense offered before a grand jury. And for the last, I guess now almost 20 months, like it was said, these men cannot come out of their homes after 7 p.m. at night until 7 a.m. the next morning. All this time, what other criminal in these streets that are arrested every night are charged and are placed under such condition as this? That's why this struggle is so important. That's why it's so important, because these guys are a victim of a political system. They're not criminals. The only crime that these men committed was to join the most progressive labor union in South Carolina, Local 1422 of the ILA. If you eliminate ILA Local 1422, so goes the labor movement in South Carolina. We are the backbone of the community. Like Bill said today, Local 1422 in Charleston is an institution. Like I said, we were blessed with a tremendous amount of resources. We have built a serious building where our building is used for all these type of meetings here every single night of the week. There's so many meetings going on in that building sometime, I got to open my own boardroom and let folks meet in there. All the progressive organization, the Progressive Network of South Carolina, 85 now different grassroots organizations of that one group, the NAACP, the Urban League, the what's the women's group? WOW? W-O-W? Yeah.
Now.
I'm sorry. Now.
Wow.
WOW is right.
There is a wild.
I thought I was right. Yeah, I was right. And so we have all these different groups that meet at our building regularly. And right now we are building a brand new facility, and we have dedicated an entire wing to the community. We are staying in the heart of the black community. But nevertheless, this trial is progressing very well, thanks to the generous contributions of trade unionists and community activists. Over the last 18 months, we have built a successful campaign. We just came out of a status conference, not a status conference, motions hearings on yesterday, and where our attorneys representing these men put on a very compelling case. The attorney general, the guy that would not let this thing go, 24 hours before the time to go to trial, gave up the ghost, as they say. He removed himself from the case and sent the case back down to a local solicitor. Would not send it to a solicitor in Charleston County because he knew it would be all over. He sent it to a solicitor in a neighboring county. That in itself is a major victory, because just 1 week ago, on a live talkback show, he pledged to the entire state of South Carolina that even though, thanks to all of you, he is coming under tremendous political pressure to drop this case, he will not drop the case, because this is about the right of every worker in South Carolina to refuse to join a union. And he will not let this go. But here, within 1 week, on the eve before the motions hearing, where motions were introduced to have him remove from the case because of his grievous conduct throughout the entire campaign, using the Charleston Five and his campaign ads for George W. Bush in the last election, using this case the day after this incident, without any investigation, calling for jail, and more jail to these men, whereas on that same Talk Back Live show, compared us with the terrorist attack that happened here on September 11th. And I have the paper right there to prove it. So we filed another motion calling for his immediate disqualification of his entire office from this case, so he finally gave it up on Wednesday. So now we stand a very, very good chance of delivering the final blow to this case. We may be able to deliver the final blow next Thursday because the judge has given this new solicitor, who really don't want this thing, 1 week to decide what he's going to do. He has 1 week to try to do his little investigation to see if there's enough factual information there to go forward with this case. If not, this guy has authority to toss this case, and the judge himself still has the authority, based on five other motions that was filed, to throw this case out. But what we are prepared to do at this point, we are still prepared to go the full distance. Our defense is solid and our defense is ready. We are determined to go the distance. But thanks to you, had it not been for the generous contributions that have come in, we have pretty much raised now, I would say, in our local defense fund, over $500,000. And every dime has come from people just like you, because we could not go into our treasuries because the state attorney general the next day had already contacted the Department of Labor and told them to watch our spendings, because if one dime of that treasury went to the defense of any one of those men, they were coming down on that local. So we had to get out immediately and start raising money. But it's been a successful campaign. It's been a long, hard struggle. You know, the campaign, in my opinion, is almost over. It's like it's crunch time now. It's time to win this thing in court. We can win it in court. We have put together what we call a dream team. We will be successful. And if this thing goes to trial, if it's not tossed out next week, and this thing goes to trial, the date will be now November the 13th. However, we are planning for an International Day of Action on the 14th, because we were told by the attorneys that on the 13th, the first day of the trial would be only jury selection. Pretty much the whole day would be just trying to select a jury. So we are planning this International Day of Action for the 14th. Dock workers around the world have pledged their solidarity, and they will do what dockers do. And then we have over 20 defense committees set up all around the country. They have pledged to do whatever they deem necessary to do. And we're expecting that the whole world would know what this is all about should they go to trial on the first day. So with that, I really thank you and being a part of this and really supporting these guys. Let me tell you, these guys have gone through a lot. Their family has gone through a lot. But it's only when we come back and tell the stories of how dedicated the people are and how much they're behind them, that they are encouraged and they are willing to fight on. We've had some of them to say that if it happened again, they'll do the exact same thing all over again. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ken Riley, for your courage and for struggling for all of us.
Thank you.
And in honor of the Charleston Five, we have really a treat. We have Amina Baraka. Amina Baraka is a singer, an actress, a poet. She's performed all over the world, and most important, she's a political activist. Amina.
Thank you. What an honor to do something. To do something with some talent. I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to feel low down. I got a right. to fight capitalism. 'Cause this old racist state keeps gunning and dragging my people down. I got a right. I got a right to sing the blues. Blues for 5-1. Kenneth Jefferson, 42. 2. Elijah Ford Jr., 40. 3. Peter Washington Jr., 48. 4. Rick Simmons, 38. 5. John Edgerton, 23. Blues for 5. I got a right to sing the blues. I got a right to fight capitalism. I got a right to stand up for the Charleston Five. Tell everybody, sing the blues. Spread the news. The Charleston Five locked down for being on a picket line, paying union dues. Spread the news. Sing the Charleston Five blues. From sun up to moon down, sing the Charleston Five blues. Brothers under house arrest for a peaceful protest. 4 black, 1 white, longshoremen fighting the right for union wages, keeping international solidarity tight. Spread the news. Sing the Charleston Five blues. 'Cause Charles Condon, state attorney hustler, union buster, dressed in Confederate gray, whistling Dixie, union traitor. Now let us spread the news. Sing the Charleston Five blues. 4 black, 1 white, facing trial, hard time for no crime. Sing a blues in every hue. South Carolina state, messing with the First Amendment, meddling with the constitutional rights. Spread the news. Sing the Charleston Five blues. Tell everybody, pass the word. Let's sing a working class anti-racist blues. Let's sing a get-together blues. One that will unite and support a blues for the Charleston Five. Let's sing a unionized blues. Victory to labor, power to the people.
Thank you, Amina. So our final speaker for closing remarks is Charlene Mitchell, who also needs no introduction. Charlene Mitchell has so many affiliations that I'll just select a couple of them. Charlene Mitchell is the assistant to the president of SSE Youth 371 of ASME, and Charlene Mitchell is also a member of the National Council of the Black Radical Congress and an active member of United New York.
I want to say, on behalf of United New York Black Radical Congress, to thank you for joining us this evening. It's been one of those evenings that you don't have very often, especially we haven't had since we've been looking at our mayor and our president so frequently. I wish they stayed hidden a little more, you know, that they had not become so people aware all of a sudden. You know, I really don't like looking at them any more now than I did before. And I hope they will go back into their bunkers. I think that one of the things that this evening has pointed to is the importance of having a radical voice in the Black community. That it is important to be able for Black people to express the needs that we have in this country. That all is not well. All is not well in the land of the free, you know, and in the home of the brave. And indeed, there are tremendous numbers of brave people, as we have seen, since September 11. And all of these people are working people. All of them are working people. Many of them are members of the district council to which my union belongs, and that's District Council 37. The Black Radical Congress is part of a national organization that was founded in 1998. And there were more than 2,000 people who came together to try to find a way to express in some kind of a collective way the concerns that we had in 1998 in terms of whether we were going to be able to make it into the new millennium with a change in Du Bois's analysis that the problem of the 20th century was the color line. The fact of the matter is that Du Bois could have been speaking right now. And so what we say is that the Black Radical Congress is a needed organization. It is needed because we see the link between two very important questions that we have been dealing with now for the last couple of years. And we have initiated a number of forums and educations on this. And that is the question of education, not incarceration. And we have made the link between the dollars that are spent for prisons that are the same amount as the dollars that have been taken away from education. We have made the link that the privatization of schools, like was meant with the Edison program, was one that was meant to put our children into private schools and then yank out from underneath them all of the monies that they would have been promised, and then they would be forced then to drop out of schools or go back to schools that now would not have the money that the taxpayers have been paying for. We were those who looked around us and saw and joined the campaign for the Drop the Rock. We know the difference in terms of what happens with our young people who go to prison instead of going to school. And we know that the money that's spent to put our young people in prison could be better spent in putting them in college. And that slogan that Jesse Jackson came out with some years ago, money for Yale, not for jail, I think is one that we could do with right easily right now in terms of this Drop the Rock campaign. I think that the campaigns that have been waged around the living wage, that the Black Radical Congress has been one to take up this issue and say that this is important for the needs of the Black community. We have been talking about joining with others on this question of reparation and slavery as a crime against humanity. And I think that in so doing, we have been able to put that together when we went as representatives of our organization to the World Conference Against Racism. Let me just say that while I've seen President Bush talking about all of us living together here in New York, that he was not able to keep a low-level delegation in Durban in South Africa. He had to walk out because they insisted on saying that slavery was a crime against humanity. Now, he has no problem talking about the crimes against humanity that are being delivered against us now in New York, and that we can all stay together. But he does have a problem with seeing it in terms of the last 400 years, and that's a different question. Let me just say that I was going to talk a bit, but Mary saved me the trouble. And, sometimes we slug it out in the Black Radical Congress, and Amiria and I do it quite often. But tonight I had nothing to say against what Amiri has raised. He gave tremendous leadership to us tonight. And I want to say that in doing that, this question of the Black Radical Congress and how we see the fight against racism, repression, and war as one fight. Now, it might have to be fought different ways at different times, but it is one fight. And as long as you have one being waged against people who are poor, people who are denied a right to a decent living, who are denied the rights that union workers, that workers must have, and they must be at union wages, that we will have a situation where people will find ways of saying a different song, singing a different song. And unless the United States is able to get ready for saying that we have to join the rest of humanity in this world and say that war is not the answer to poverty. War is not the answer to poverty. And war is not the answer to terrorism. The answer to terrorism is to bring those who are guilty to justice.
That's right.
And we need to bring those who are guilty to justice. But we also need to recognize that there are things that produce terrorism and that we need to answer those questions as well. And that those things that cause crimes against humanity are those very same things that cause the same kinds of crimes here in our own country. And to keep people in house arrest in the good old free USA for 2 years for the right to organize is a crime against humanity. The other thing, and I just want to repeat it, is that since the trial starts on November 13th for the Charleston Five, that on the International Day of Action, that we all find a way to participate in some form of action in defense of the Charleston Five. Thank you very much for coming.
Ken Riley's speech was given on Friday, October 12th. On Monday, October 15th, Walter Bailey Jr., the new prosecutor of the case, consented to the lifting of the curfew on the Charleston Five, and Judge Vic Rawl signed the order releasing the men. This has been Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report in Exile, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. For more information on the Charleston Five Defense Committee, you can call 212-684-3641. That's 212-684-3641. Or online at www.charleston5defense.org. And you can contact Building Bridges at knash@igc.org. For Building Bridges, Your Community and Labor Report in Exile, this is Ken Nash with Mimi Rosenberg in solidarity.